you'd want at the plate is the guy at the plate for the Blue Jays. Can he do it one more time tonight? Again, the 2-2, and he chased a ball in the dirt down and away. Perez has it, snaps the throw down to first. Guerrero strikes out, and the Royals will hang on to win it, beating the Blue Jays 7-5 here in Game 1 of this series.
Against the boards, grabbed off by the Jets. They shoot it at the empty net, and in it goes. Kyle Connor will put the finishing touches on this one with 36.1 seconds left, with an empty net goal to make it 5-2.
Giving up three in the first, it's unacceptable. I put the team and David in a really tough spot, and I just know I can be a lot better than that.
We're smelling the weekend now, We have no idea what the weekend looks like for the Maple Leafs, other than they're not playing in Vancouver tomorrow night. But we're smelling the weekend nonetheless.
I guess the league decided to listen to the players. I mean, what else could it be at this point? The league was on a call with them, and I just want to know where the players' union's at in all this. Like, how much are they involved? I would love to know. I haven't heard anything yet. But that's what it is for me. How can you make a team? We talked about it yesterday. One practice, it's tough after a week or two. You know, imagine 3 weeks. It's just at this point, you need 2, 3, 4 days to get back into it. And guys are hurting. Guys are struggling on the Canucks.
Well, we'll have a little bit of a talk later about the players' union and its involvement. Elliot Friedman, of course, will be along at the top of the 8 o'clock hour, and we'll get his perspective on it. I just wonder if the players' union is always pulled in a couple of different directions in a situation like this. You have the concerns specifically for and of the Vancouver Canucks players, and then you have the concerns of other players around the league who realize that any missed games potentially means lost television revenue, and players on the Dallas Stars or the New Jersey Devils would be saying, hey, we missed a bunch of time and had to make it all up, so what's the deal? Like, I can see where there would be competing points of view. So we'll come back to this a little bit later, Ziggy, because Gord Stellick's coming up in just a few minutes, and we got to talk about last night's game. No Austin Matthews for the Leafs. Apparently it's not serious. Chris Johnston wrote on Sportsnet.ca yesterday that it is similar to or directly related to the left hand wrist thing that kept Austin out of three games earlier this season. So they go without their best goal scorer. He, of course, is pursuing the Rocket Richard Trophy, which is the least of our concerns. We want him healthy and playing well into June and July. But no Austin Matthews. Still no power play to talk about. Jack Campbell arguably shaky on the first goal, and it was a tough night for Mitch Marner, and the Leafs get drubbed.
The first goal, good shot, not the best angle. I wasn't too thrilled with it. It was a good shot, but that first one from Ehlers, power play goal. Yeah, he was screened a little bit, went off his glove. If I'm on the ice, that's a shot I want to give up if I'm the Toronto Maple Leafs. We talk about this. You play against good players, play against good power plays. You got to give up something. That's something I don't mind. That shot from Ehlers on the left-hand side, I don't mind giving that up. So he's got to come up with that. The second one from Kyle Connor, kind of a broken, you know, 2-on-1 breakaway down the left side. I'd like my goaltender to come up with that more times than not. So I'll give that one a 50-50. The breakaway from Scheifele, I don't know.
Freddie's getting killed. If Mark Scheifele scores on a breakaway on him, I'm telling you.
I know that, but I let you know about the breakaways. The breakaway, you don't want to hang your goaltender out.
I agree.
Breakaway shouldn't happen. Like that's a serious breakdown. Either I believe a breakaway usually is two mistakes, and it shouldn't happen. Like whatever system you have in place should guard against that. And I know it was a battle for a puck on the right boards, and then it was coming out, and then it was getting kept in. Muzzin kind of stepped up to the blue line. He got caught going the wrong way, and Scheifele, he read it perfectly, the situation. Read the play great. So the breakaways are going to go in, but you'd like your goaltender more times than not to come up with them. I don't think Campbell was very good. And this is the worry I was talking about, right? There's going to come a time where he's going to have a bad game. Bad goals are going to go in. He's going to be put in a tough position. What's he made of then? Everything has been going perfect, right? Until the last couple games. It's just funny seeing stuff, you know, hearing his performance yesterday. It's like the fans are ready to move on again.
No,
it's like not move on again. No, not move on again. But it's like, it's the same treatment. It's like one bad game and it's like, okay, where's Redick at? It's like, we're never satisfied in this town.
Right. And I do think there's a broader topic to discuss unrelated to the goaltending here, which we can get to in a minute. I tweeted this last night and I firmly believe it. I'm willing to listen to any argument that Freddie Anderson has been a part of the problem at times this year. And when we talk about problems, it's all relative. I mean, the Leafs have one of the best records in the NHL. I can listen to an argument that he's been a problem, or if your opinion is that he's the problem. But that's just one part of the equation. The other part of the equation that I have far less time for is that, and I'm now saying this again, you cannot definitively declare that Jack Campbell is the solution. Based on a sample size this year in Toronto, dating back to his arrival in Toronto last year and really over the course of his career, based on a sample size that is A, small, and B, really spaced out. So we can talk about Freddie, but you can't say with certainty that Jack Campbell is the solution to what ails this team in net. He may end up becoming that. He may end up being that, but we don't know that yet, and nobody can claim to know that. The whole goaltending conversation feels desperate to me because of Freddie's play, right? And people are worried about what this is going to look like when the playoffs start. If Freddie is playing and doesn't make that big save, well, then we got to fall back to Jack. And what if a bad goal goes in at an inopportune time on him? And on it goes. I think Leafs fans believe this team is good enough to get to the Final Four. And if it's good enough to get to the Final Four with a bounce here and a bit of luck there and some well-played games spread all around, the Maple Leafs could contend legitimately for the Stanley Cup. The fear of this fan base is that the goaltending's going to sink it.
Well, they're not the only team in the NHL that is worried about that. I would say half the playoff teams are just kind of questioning, well, are we going to get this goaltending in the playoffs? Other teams are saying, gosh, I hope our goaltenders show up at some point. And other teams are saying, I don't know who the guy is going to be in the playoffs. Like, we're not the only, this isn't the only organization.
Right, but this is one of the biggest fan bases.
What's happening in Montreal?
One of the most focused fan bases.
Like, what's happening in Montreal with Allen and Price? Like, they just don't. Well, they don't even know what's going on there.
Yeah, they're praying Carey Price dials it back a decade come playoff time. Yeah. Right? That's what they're hoping for.
Yeah, I'm just making a point. You don't really know, there's a lot of teams that have question marks in net. So are the Leafs any different? No. Campbell's been excellent. You're not going to be great every night. I don't think those three goals were terrible. I would just like my goaltender to come up with two of the three. Like, one of those is going to go in. Come up with two of the three.
But that's the same conversation as we have about Freddie, right?
I know.
Get me a save, baby.
Well, this is the conversation you have with every starter. If Campbell's your starter, that's what we're going to talk about. I'm wondering if this was Campbell's, like, say Campbell was going in to give Freddie a rest right now, would he have been pulled in that same situation? That's kind of what That's what the question you have to come with now. Like, were you not, if you were, as a fan, if you weren't happy with any of those goals, if Freddie was here and that was Campbell's one game every 2 weeks kind of thing,
you probably wouldn't.
you probably don't pull him after three and put your starter back in.
Well, they did that in Ottawa, though, that night, that Sunday night right before their five-day break.
You're
but
right.
You don't want to get used to doing that. You don't want to go to that well very often.
Yeah, I just I thought Campbell would have gone in back when the period ended. Then you know what I mean?
Yes.
I thought he would have gone in this. I thought it was like pull him for 5 minutes, let him sit there, see it, think about it, regroup in the intermission, and then throw him back out. And the fact they didn't, you got to remember, this is a lot of games for Campbell. All right, talk about, like, you got to be, what I say about Campbell, it's like 8 wins, 9 wins, 10 wins, and I'm
it
just kind of like
100%.
Be cautious. He hasn't been a starter before. Him trying to play every game is going to take a little bit of time. I told you what Freddie does and how important that is from your starting goaltender to log the minutes to have that workload. Campbell hasn't had it yet, and you're going to get games like this until he finds his way as a starter. You can't just, guy can't win 8 games and say, okay, he's our starter moving forward. I told you it's not the case. And you're going to get games like this. Do you have the stomach for it to, like, this? Do you come back with Campbell your next game, or do you leave Riddick in the net right now? Like, yeah, that's, I mean, I know you're, I thought Riddick played well, except for the one kind of misplay on the Marner on the Marner back check giveaway. I think Riddick was excellent.
Right. And I think that conversation point, it's a toss up anyway, because the Leafs are going to play a ton of games here. And if the Saturday, Monday in Vancouver gets pushed to Sunday, Tuesday, as is possible, what does that mean for the Wednesday game in Winnipeg? Because they're supposed to be in Winnipeg Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. Well, you can't turn the Wednesday game into a Thursday game. You can't play three in a row. Would they actually go back-to-back, losing 2 hours, flying to Winnipeg in the process, playing Tuesday in Vancouver, Wednesday in Winnipeg? So both goaltenders, whoever they are, it's Campbell and Riddick right now, but the two goaltenders are going to get plenty of opportunity to play upcoming.
Well, that schedule can't happen. I don't think you can play a Tuesday. I don't think you can play a back-to-back with one day off and back-to-back, right?
Because
it would go Tuesday. Yeah, it would go Tuesday, Wednesday, off Thursday, play Friday, Saturday. I don't think you can play 4 and 5.
Well, this is the domino.
There's like a rule.
Yeah, this is the domino effect too. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know what Winnipeg's schedule is. Maybe you can move the Friday game to Sunday so that you and push the Wednesday game in Winnipeg to Thursday. But I'd have to look at the Jets.
Yeah, that's
schedule.
What would happen.
Because I'm not here to speak for the corporation, but I would imagine that Leafs Jets next Saturday night is a game that our employers want on our television screens, right? So the Saturday game can't get compromised in all of this. That's just an assumption I make.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they can do. This was going to be the deal, right? With the schedule and COVID and condensed, and games were going to get missed.
Marv Levy, the former Buffalo Bills head coach, former head coach of the Montreal Alouettes for 5 years in the mid-1970s, has just been inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. He is 95 years old, turning 96 this summer. He will be our guest coming up at 6:35. Here is Gord Stellick, the co-host of Leafs Nation pre and post here on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, he's with us on mornings after Leafs games. Gord, we've touched on a bunch of things, and we'll come back to those topics with you. I'll throw another one out that I wanted to get to, which is the moment you're without Austin Matthews, and apparently the hand wrist thing is not serious, so that's good news. It's just the lingering thing he's been dealing with. The moment you're without Austin Matthews and William Nylander, they got numbers, but the depth truly takes a hit on this Leafs roster, doesn't it?
Yeah, no question. And Scott and Ziggy, and, you know, you look at, okay, so say it's the Winnipeg Jets you're playing, and you think about them in the bubble, and in the first period they lose Mark Scheifele and Patrick Laine, and that changes the whole dynamic. So for every team, there's a situation like that, but they've, you know, I think, Scott, the best example is what the Washington Capitals did when when their Russian players, their elite Russian players, all gathered inappropriately COVID-wise in a room after a game. And what they missed like 10 days or so, and they just kept on winning. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I thought John Tavares in particular has really picked it up the last few games. But if you're without your big guns, it's going to hurt you. But if you are a great team, if you truly are a great team, those are the kind of things you overcome.
Wanted your thoughts on Nick Robertson last night. It hasn't played a lot this year, but getting a little bit more of an increased role, more minutes, power play time. What'd you think about the young prospect that looks like a regular?
Well, you know, Ziggy, it's funny, and just hearing you guys talk about the game as well. When they unbelievably with a 1-0 lead and then could do nothing on that 2-man power play, I ceased to have any ability to analyze anything for a little while because, just said, how the hell did they get down 3-1 so quickly in a game they were totally in control? So obviously that changes the dynamics of the game and, changes a situation like Nick Robertson, playing in a more comfortable thing when they've got the lead, whatever. Instead, they're chasing the game and there's more sense of urgency. But to answer your question, I like them. What I saw again last night, I liked. I think there's all these different spices now that Sheldon keeps looking at. Certainly, Sabourin is one extreme for the physicality. Nick Robertson, a smaller skill guy. And then other guys that he's putting in. And now because of the injuries and the COVID protocol to Nylander, has to have that opportunity to put in. So I like what he brings. I like that element that he brings. What a great draft pick.
I feel like the way we're assessing the goaltending with this team, Gord, is based in a fear that we have as people who talk about this team, I suppose, but certainly as a fan base, that this team is good enough to get to the Final Four, get through the two rounds of the North Division playoffs. And if it's good enough to get to the Final Four, it's good enough to win the Stanley Cup. You play some good games, you get a bounce here, a little bit of luck there, and there could be a parade in Toronto. And I know to get from A to Z, that's a long way, but that's a real brief way of describing a much longer period of time. The fear I think the fan base has is the goaltending going to sink us? Whether it's Frederick or whether it's Jack Campbell, I don't lay last night at Jack Campbell's feet, but I do agree with Ziggy. There was a get me a save, please goal in that game. And I'm starting to look at the Maple Leafs goaltending like I look at a lot of starting pitching in Major League Baseball. Just give us a chance to win and don't do anything that takes us out of the game too soon.
Yeah, it's like a great defense in football with a bad offense kind of saying, just don't fumble or intercept the ball. Give us a chance to do that. And I thought Sheldon Keefe had the good line last night, just basically said it was quick. Jack Campbell certainly struggled on particularly the one goal he'd want to have back. And then Sheldon Keefe just said, look, I just thought we're going to bail him out. He's bailed us out so many times. It just wasn't in the cards. And Scott, every time, or pretty well every time we talk, we again go back to fans could accept they were disappointed, dejected the 7 games losses to Boston. But the malaise against Columbus, the bubble malaise, and again getting out goaltended in yet another playoff series, doesn't mean it was horrible goaltending, but you got out goaltended, you got out playoff played. And that's what happened. So if it's a paranoia, I think it's well placed because that's exactly what's happened. The flip side, to your point, the Toronto Maple Leafs, when we talk after a win or when things are going well, you're saying, okay, this could be the St. Louis Blues of a couple of years ago. This could be a team getting pieces together, rolling in a good way, getting some depth, and being good enough then to run the table like St. Louis did a couple of years ago. So those are kind of the two extremes. And again, it'll all come down to game number 57 to see what the reality is. I don't have any big worries, given the Leafs the way they are right now, about how getting through the regular season.
It seemed like yesterday pucks were bouncing off sticks. They were losing the handle, weren't defending well. The puck just didn't seem to go their way. On the one Marner play where he kind of came back into his own end, Ehlers was hounding him down, lost the handle. What did you make of that play? Was that just Marner getting outworked and, not being on the right side of a defensive play? Or do you kind of tip your, cap at Ehlers in the way he hounded Marner down and then beat Rittich to a puck that Rick tried playing?
Yeah, I think Mitch Marner's done a really good job, worked hard at being a two-way player. He'd want to have that back to you. Like you say, the wrong side of the puck is a subtle thing. Quite often when you're that skilled and that fast, you don't worry about it because you're used to getting yourself out of jam. So I'll give Ehlers some props that way. And then, of course, Marner, after that happens, you're going, geez, I hope the goaltender can bail me out. And that was the only one. I think David Rittich, he's got to go in the Leafs archive library and get the Johnny Bower poke check video out to see the black and white version to see exactly how the legend did it in the 1960s, because that was the only kind of whiff there. But I'll more give Ehlers, who is really, I think, I don't know if he's an underrated player still, because I think people are starting to appreciate him more and more. But I'll give Ehlers credit on that.
With Gord Stellick on leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So the Leafs really don't know what their schedule is going to be here, Gord. They're not playing in Vancouver tomorrow night, so the Canucks are not playing the Oilers tonight. Tomorrow's game in Vancouver, Leafs-Canucks postponed. It could move to Sunday, which could push Monday's game in Vancouver to Tuesday, and then you've got the 3-4 situation in Winnipeg. First and foremost, the health and wellness of Vancouver Canucks players, their staff, the families of all of these people, that matters. That matters more than anything. But we're starting to see the domino effects play out here now, right? All this talk about needing to use the buffer week, the delay to the start of the North Division playoffs. Well, the Leafs are now directly affected here because the schedule changes this coming week, and it may become even more compacted than it already was.
Yeah, and I heard you guys talking earlier, and, you know, whatever rules they might be, COVID world, there are no rules. I mean, the rules are that David Rittich gets traded and has to go on a charter plane with the team that traded him 36 hours later, because you've got to either drive or take a chartered plane to get to your new destination. So, that would never happen pre-COVID. So we're going to get something formally announced today about it. No question about it. It's going to be an incredible grind for a lot of people, and first and foremost, to your point, you articulated quite well about the Vancouver Canucks. A little thing I'm sort of thinking about now, Scott and Ziggy, there's been this set in stone, we are going to play 56 games regardless. I got to think, and I'll use this one as an example, that there's got to be a little bit of wiggle room that, okay, you know what, we get in another pickle, say the Canucks play 54 games. So two teams miss a game. Say Toronto plays 55. Say Edmonton plays 55 because their game's against Vancouver. You can't find a place to play them. So you don't need to play them if it comes down to not, you know, making the playoffs or not making the playoffs. If Vancouver gets that close, then maybe, you know, kind of like game number 163 in baseball, you have that one-game playoff, right? I think a little bit, though, concerned about percentages is about the draft lottery. That's the other side about it. Okay, because those picks are so great if you don't make the playoffs. So I think that's what they're, you know, trying to figure out. I mean, last year they did go to winning percentages when it came down to it, when they had the expanded playoff format, and it's Buffalo that got eliminated by the narrowest of margins. So I got to think that's a little bit, maybe not the front burner, but the back burner is a possibility.
We'll talk again next week, Gord. Should be a fascinating weekend, whether or not the Leafs play. We'll know a lot more by the time we chat next. Thanks, pal.
Well, you talk about Buffalo. I can't wait to hear Marv Levy, so looking forward to that as well.
He is an absolute prince, an absolute prince. 95 years in the books, 95 more to come. We'll talk soon. Thanks, Gord.
Thanks, guys.
Gord Stellick with Nick Alberga, the co-host of Leafs Nation Pre and Post here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. And Gord teed it up for us. Marv Levy has just been inducted into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame for his 5 seasons as a head coach of the Montreal Alouettes in the 1970s. He won 2 Grey Cups during that time. He, of course, the head coach of the Buffalo Bills teams that went to 4 consecutive Super Bowls in the early 1990s. He is 95 years old. Marv Levy, the great Marv Levy, is with us next.
The Canadian Football Hall of Fame is out with its induction class for the year 2021, and we are pleased to be joined by the person I would argue is the headliner of the list. He is the former head coach of the Buffalo Bills, the team that went to 4 consecutive Super Bowls in the early 1990s. Prior to that, and hence his induction into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, the former head coach of the Montreal Alouettes for 5 seasons in the mid-70s, during which he won 2 Grey Cups. We welcome to the program the great Marv Levy. Mark, thanks for your time this morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and I appreciate your kind comments. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to the great fans there, and I hope they're all doing well during this terrible coronavirus virus pandemic campaign and that we conquer it too.
Absolutely. So let's kick off with your time in Montreal from 1973 to 1977. 5 years, you win two Grey Cups, 74 and 77. You've come from the NFL where you were a special teams coordinator. What was the adjustment to Canadian football like for you, and what led you to come north of the border?
Okay, well, very interesting. Yes, I spent 5 years there out of a 47-year-long coaching career, but they sure were memorable years in many ways. I hadn't known much about it before I arrived up there. But through a bunch of my previous coaching career in the States, in college, and with some of the pro teams, there was a scout for the Montreal Alouettes, who later became their general manager, I should say, named J.I. Albrecht. And he used to come to the practices where I was coaching, and we struck up a friendship. And apparently he was favorably impressed with my coaching. And we had just gone to the Super Bowl in the 1972 season when I was with the Washington Redskins. And he recommended the Montreal Alouettes team owner, Sam Berger, that he interview me for the position. I was glad to go up and be interviewed. I was enamored with the city, with the history of it, with Mr. Berger, his young family, and all the people I met. And when they offered me the job, I took it. There was a lot to learn. I realized that. The rules are different, the size of the field different, how many men in motion and what all that. But you got to make you're making adjustments all the time as a coach, and I'm sure in every other profession as well.
How did that experience help you get back to head coaching in the NFL? Because you were, like you said, you're an assistant coach with Washington the year before. You go to the Super Bowl, then you go coach in Montreal, and then come back to the NFL. How did that whole experience in Canada, help you become a great NFL coach?
Well, again, I had been an assistant in the NFL for a while. My last 3 years under a great coach who's a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, George Allen. And I learned a lot, but going up to Canada to become a head coach, you experience some wonderful things. You realize that the popularity of the game is dependent on three almost equally important components. One, the participants, players and coaches. Two, the fans who get, and three, the media that conveys that between them all. And so, but I learned a lot. I learned how much you have to adapt to the situation. So many different rules. Jokingly speaking, when J.A. Albrecht offered me the job, he said, "Marv, you can have 12 men on the field. In Canada, there are only 11, of course, as everybody knows, in U.S. football." And I said, "Oh, great, okay." And after my first game, I walked into J.A.'s office and said, "Jay, you didn't tell me the other team could have 12 men, too." Well, so what?
Yeah. And how many times, you got to make quick adjustments, Marv. There's no question about it. But how many times were you able to go outside the box because you had that extra guy? What kind of adjustments did you make? How creative were you able to be, perhaps in ways that you hadn't been before?
Well, first of all, there is a lot to learn when you go up there, but something I found out very soon, and that pervaded all the time I was there, whether it was in the Canadian League or coaching in the U.S., was this. It takes, even though there are differences in the rules and you have to adapt to it, you're always making adjustments. The game always changes. The nature of the game always changes. But I did realize that whether you're playing in the U.S. or in Canada, if you run, throw, block, tackle, catch, kick better than your opponent, you're going to win most of the time. Fundamentals. You have to, teaching fundamentals is the most important thing. Not the strategies and what formation you're running and if you're in a no huddle or what. Those things, you make them work. But if you can't handle the fundamentals better than your opponent, you're not going to win.
Marv Levy is our guest, and he is now a member of the Canadian Football Hall of Fame class of 2021, one-time head coach of the Montreal Alouettes, and of course the head coach of the Buffalo Bills from the mid-80s until the late 90s. You're listening to Lead Off, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
What were some of your most memorable moments coaching in Buffalo?
Well, how much warm clothes I had to put on towards the end of the season. Well, I came to Buffalo, and the weather was rough there. So when the team owner, Ralph Wilson, a wonderful guy, offered me the job, he said, Marv, there are two seasons here in Buffalo. He said, the 4th of July and winter. And I learned what great fans there were. They were so supportive, even when we lost those Super Bowl games, how supportive they were. I once had told them in a huge meeting downtown that you are the reason we'll go back to the Super Bowl. Great fans there, and possibly you know this, but about 20% of the fan base that came to our games when I was with the Buffalo Bills did come from Canada, across the borders.
And that is still true to this day, Marv. I mean, there's a huge Bills fan contingent around the Golden Horseshoe. And, of course, for a few years, the Bills would play one home game each year in the Rogers Centre here in Toronto.
Right.
When you look back on your days as the head coach of the Bills, I want to get to the Super Bowls in just a moment. But one of the regular season rivalries that obviously stands out of the AFC East is Buffalo-Miami. I know people who are newer to the game or younger are going to say, well, where do the New England Patriots fit into this? They came a little after your run. But Buffalo-Miami, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, Marv Levy, Don Shula. I mean, you must look back on that time and just think, wow. I mean, when you're living it, you're feeling the pressure, but you look back. I mean, those were some epic, epic games twice a year.
Yes, they were. And I was competing against another head coach for whom I had such high regard. Don Shula and I, he passed away just about a year or so ago, remained good friends. I had great regard for him. We exchanged many communications. But he was the essence, the winningest coach of all time in the NFL, of course. And he taught clean football. He honored the game. And our fans in both places were not abusive. The fans, yes, they competed strongly with each other, and I'm sure they had great fans. We did, too. I can't tell you how many times I've been in airports all around the country, and someone will come up to me and say, I'm the number one Buffalo Bills fan. And finally, I had to say one day, I've never met the number two Buffalo Bills fan. But that happened.
4 times you go to the Super Bowl between 1990 and 93. What were those years like? Because just getting to the big dance is so tough. And as a fan, as a Bills fan, just my team getting there is I'd be happy with, right? How many teams don't even, have a shot at it? Was that tough after the first couple where you're like, okay, we get there the first year, doesn't happen, second year. Was there added pressure those third and fourth years?
Well, the reason, one of the main reasons we did wasn't just the ability on our team, it was the character of the members of our team. And I can remember the day I was interviewed for the head coaching job, general manager Bill Polian, my wonderful friend now too, sitting in the office with team owner Ralph Wilson, for whom I have great regard. We all, I don't know who suggested it or brought the subject up, but we all decided we would bring a board on our team only people of high character. Now, their personalities might differ. Some might be extroverts, some introverts, but did they show up for work on time? Did they not blame their teammates? Did they work hard on fundamentals? Were they good citizens? Those were the only kind of guys we brought onto our team. Once in a rare while, we might have made a mistake, but we didn't keep a guy like that very long. So this is one of the reasons we bounced back. That plus, as I say, the tremendous support we got from the Buffalo Bills. So many of them just kept cheering us back on despite the bitterness of losing those games. I do recall one. There's an exception to every rule on a radio show I used to do a day or two after the game, and when we lost, I think our second Super Bowl. One fan calling in and saying, "Coach, please don't go back to the Super Bowl. I can't stand it. It hurts. It's killing me." I said, "Sir, I understand your anguish, but I'm glad you're not on my team."
That's great line. Great line. You know, Ziggy and I had the opportunity. This was obviously before the pandemic. It was the kickstart to the 2019 NFL season, if I remember correctly. Daryl Talley came into studio with Ziggy and me. And I'll tell you, Marv, if Daryl Talley had told me to go out and fly a plane, I got no business being a pilot, but he could have motivated me to do it. I mean, you talk about high-character guys. Just the 20-minute conversation we had with him that day, man, oh, man, that guy was a warrior in the middle of your defense.
That's true, and I used to say about Daryl, he not only had character, he was a character. I tell you, I don't know if you got a word in edgewise when he was there. But he was a great leader on our team, Daryl, and he was a different personality, very entertaining in many ways, and I still stay in touch with him from time to time.
Who's somebody that impacted you as a coach? Either a coaching clinic, seminar, or somebody you worked under?
Well, George Allen, certainly. I was an assistant to George in the NFL, and he was a magnificent leader. He did focus on fundamentals. George never used a swear word in his life. It was always dad dratted or something like that if he got upset. But he was a great teacher. And then when I was just a young college coach, even an assistant beginning in college, I went one summer to a clinic all over the country where the most outstanding college football coach in the country, Bud Wilkinson, was speaking. And about the sixth one I went to, he looked down to you and said, "Are you here again?" And he said, "Come here." He invited me up to his room. He invited me to their practices. I got to know him. He was another guy who, what a football coach, what a man of high character, had great impact on my coaching career.
Marv Levy is our guest. He is going into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame class of 2021. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Just a couple of more items regarding the four Super Bowls, Marv. Scott Norwood always got a bum rap. I mean, I can understand criticism of a guy who misses a chip shot, 27, 28, 30-yard field goal the last second. I get it. I mean, that would be tough in and of itself, but I'd understand it more. Scott Norwood missed a 47-yard field goal wide right. All the flack he took, how hard was that for you, the team, to experience, and how did you rally to his side?
Well, yeah, okay, that's a great story. What people don't know is Scott was with us for two of our Super Bowls, the first two. And, yes, he missed that kick, and we lost the game, and I'll come back to it in a minute. But there were, during that season, six games that we won in the dying seconds when Scott kicked the winning field goal. Okay, back to the loss, the wide right, 47-yard field goal with just 8 seconds left to play. We arrived back in Buffalo, and when we arrived there, we were supposed to go back to our facility, and we had a final team meeting. But instead, the buses took us to downtown Buffalo in into, golly, I can't remember the name of the square. We were ushered into a city hall building, out onto the balcony, and down below were 30,000 people welcoming us home after the loss and cheering the team, and wait till next year, they were chanting. And then they started to chant, "We want Scott. We want Scott. We want Scott." Scott stepped up. He's a rather quiet, soft-spoken guy, but he did say, look down, and he said, "You are the reason we will be going back to the Super Bowl next year." And in the following, and in both those Super Bowls we went to, as I may have said already, Scott kicked the winning points on the way to him in several games.
That's I remember the city rallying around him. I also remember all those people saying, you know, how do you miss a field goal like that? It just always stunned me. The cool thing for us Canadians, Marv, is that after Scott left the Bills, Steve Christie, who's from the GTA, Oakville, came in and kicked for you guys and did a great job. What made Jim Kelly great?
What made Jim Kelly? Well, certainly his character, his raw ability, and his teammates, and a family. He was one of six brothers, several of them very good football players. He had great parents. I met them. But Jim Kelly, he had raw ability, but he was tougher than 47 miles of detour. He could bounce back. He had the greatest backup quarterback that ever played the game that helped push him forth in Frank Reich, now an outstanding coach at the Indianapolis Colts. There were so many things. Jim Kelly had character. He's now a wonderful father and husband, still living in Buffalo. Funny thing, Jim had not wanted to be drafted. He went to school down at the University of Miami, even though he's from Pittsburgh. He had not wanted to go to pro football in Buffalo. He didn't like the weather, he said. And after about 10 years there, Jim Kelly said, "No one ever wants to come to Buffalo," he said. "And once they get here, no one ever wants to leave." He hasn't left. He's still there.
All right, I got to ask you something personal. Turning 96, you sound great. I've seen you do media interviews on some U.S. networks. What's your secret?
Well, really, I never did drugs. I smoked so briefly, you know, just a few cigars, and I gave that up. Any drinking I do is very moderate. As Dean Martin once said, he drinks moderately. He just ordered a case of moderately today, but I won't say that one. surrounded by great family, starting with my parents, my wife, my children, my whole family. I have a huge family. My father was one of 13 children. So I got a cousin. I can't go anywhere downtown here in Chicago for a walk without someone stopping me and saying, "I married your cousin Jerry's granddaughter Sylvia." You know, okay, fine.
Listen, sir, it's an absolute honor to speak to you, and Ziggy and I both congratulate you on this honor, a long time coming, 2021 Canadian Football Hall of Fame inductee. A wonderful first 95 years. Here's to 95 more.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you and communicating with your listeners and the fine fans up there. Thank you.
The one, the only, former Montreal Alouettes head coach, former Buffalo Bills head coach, Marv Levy. Leafs fall to the Jets. The Blue Jays lose in Kansas City. And the Raptors, pursuing a playoff spot, are resting everybody tonight. The panel weighs in next. Oh, Marv Levy, huh?
Sharp as a tack. You could listen to that guy for hours and hours.
I'm getting a lot of texts right now. Yeah, people are.
I'm telling you, Ziggy,
they're loving it.
You asked the best question of the interview. What's your secret? I because the funny thing is, the way that he answered that, I have no idea if any of us have the ability to make up for all of the things We did. And he's like, I never did any drugs. I only smoked for a brief period of time and
drank moderately.
No, but he's like, I didn't smoke. I thought it was I didn't smoke.
He said I smoked only briefly.
And a few cigars, and he gave those up too. Yeah.
Which,
good for him.
I mean, if you're not smoking cigarettes in the mid-1940s as a teenager, 20-year-old,
you're
like
a social pariah.
You were an out, not, I don't know if you were an outcast, but you were you were the exception, not the rule.
That's an era where doctors were recommending cigarettes.
Like, recommend, yes.
Exactly.
Get that in you.
Yeah.
You know that
cool
thing
where
you suck on a little stick and then you blow smoke out your face?
Yeah.
Get that in. That's got to be good for you.
Do you guys remember the candies? Remember Popeye cigarettes? Do you remember those? The little candy
Ziggy
sticks?
Say,
they look like cigarettes?
Ziggy say no, and then Hugh will think he's really way older.
Yeah, I'm not really sure here. Yeah, please explain these. Yeah.
It was the gateway to nicotine, really, is when we're kids.
The gateway drug was Popeye sticks. Popeye cigarettes.
They tasted good.
Marv Levy, fantastic interview. Turns 96
wow.
later this summer. And I think we'll cop to the truth of this. He's in the Midwest, so he's an hour behind us. So we spoke to him late yesterday morning. And what we thought we would do, because he tells a really good story that we didn't have time for at 6:30, is bring him back at 8:30 and include that story.
Nice.
In the full interview, and it's got to do with the 1945 World Series at Wrigley Field, and of course the Cubs for a very long time didn't do a whole lot of winning.
No, they did not.
So between 1945 and 2016, there was not a World Series game played at Wrigley Field. So for that, 70-year chunk of time, Marv Levy had attended the most recent World Series game at Wrigley, and then he went back to Wrigley. He's a Chicago. The story being, he's a Chicago guy.
Yeah,
that's where he was born and raised. So
amazing.
Kind of a cool thing. He was back at a World Series game in 2016. As obviously a much older person. Leafs fall 5-2 to the Jets. We have no idea what's going on here, other than they're not playing tomorrow in Vancouver.
Yeah, no official word yet, but that's exactly what we expect.
Seems like Sunday's a possibility. The one thing we know is if the Canucks are going to get all their games in, you can't keep pushing them back. That shouldn't necessarily be the priority, but it seems to be. On the Leafs-Jets front, Toronto came out of the gate pretty strongly, but the power play continues to just drag its heels. They are one for their last 43 with the man advantage. Ziggy, they had a 71-second 5-on-3 last night, didn't score, and we didn't do a whole lot. We did our share, but I don't think we did a whole lot on the power play during their 9-0-1 run because they were winning hockey games. Now that they've started to drop a few, we're back focused on the man advantage, which they have to get organized by playoff time.
They do, and you don't need a power play to win. We've seen that. We've seen other teams do it. The problem is that when you go to kill a penalty and yet you let one in within 10 seconds, that's an issue. That's the first thing. The second part is, okay, if your 5-on-4 is not going, make sure your 5-on-3 is. I've said it here many times. You don't score on your power play, you will lose your game more often than not. And that happened again last night.
Your
two-man
advantage. Yep. Yeah,
you go 5-on-3, you don't score. It's a big issue. That's the only thing. The 5-on-3, you have 70 seconds. You lose the draw. They get it down. They didn't get set up till 30, 35 seconds left in the 5-on-3. So they didn't even have a full 70 seconds at it. You have to win that draw. That should never happen. I didn't like that part of it. It's almost like they're looking around, you know, they're in between right now. It's waiting for the right play, but no, I have to keep it simple. The issue is when you get that much skill on the ice, you want the perfect shot, the perfect play. You don't just want to throw anything at the net. Look at Winnipeg did last night in Ehlers. Get the puck over, back up to the middle, over to the one flank, walk in, get a guy in front of the net and shoot the puck. There's nothing flashy about it. It was a bad angle. If you want to take a shot on the power play, that's not the one you want. And Hugh, I don't know what you think about the Leafs power play right now or what's ailing it, but I think they have to go even more meat and potatoes.
I was going to ask you that, Ziggy. So especially on the 5-on-3, you talk about them. There's so much skill in the ice. They're always looking to make that perfect pass and have that just beautiful highlight reel goal. Are you suggesting just pound the puck at the net and bang it in on the rebound if you have to? Don't get cute. Just do something to break out of this slump? That kind of the mindset they should have right now?
Or, so you have to, there's a couple different ways you can work with a power play. First, you keep it super simple. Up to the top, shoot it. That hasn't worked. Well, get a low play going. Haven't really seen a lot of creative low plays. It looks like the puck's being forced into the middle. That's an issue. The problem with the power play and our personnel and the skill we have is that you don't just, they're not getting pucks back. I think that's an underlying issue right now. So it's not just good PKs they're going against, or it's a slump, or they're not getting the chances. It's when pucks are going to the net, they're not getting to rebounds, they're not getting to loose pucks, they're not getting the puck back.
But that sounds like an effort thing to me. Yeah. Like when you say that, like when they're not getting the puck, when they're not winning the loose puck battles, to me that's like you're kind of sounding like that's an effort thing.
Yeah, I mean it's a skill thing that it's. It's like rebounding in the NBA. Sometimes in basketball, sometimes you're not in a position. You're never in the right spot. Other times, you have to box out. You have to get in the tough areas. And it's the same as hockey when you're trying to pick up a rebound or a loose puck. So there's a little bit of timing, a little bit of luck. But when you work hard and you battle, you come up with those pucks more often than not. So that's the one thing where it's like they're cautious about putting the puck on net because they're not getting them back. And that's a bad place to be right now. And now everyone's talking about it. You know, when you start focusing on something, it becomes that much worse. I don't see it seeping into the rest of their game though. Like it's not affecting it. You still don't see guys yelling at each other. Let me tell you this, on most teams I've played on, when you go 1-for-40, there's going to be a lot of problems when you get back to the bench. Guys are going to be talking about it. Guys are going to be not pointing fingers, but guys are going to hear about where you're in the right spot, you know, zone entries, hanging onto the puck, shot selection. Those all start coming into play. And right now, something has to change. And I know it was a crazy idea that I've mentioned here last couple weeks, but you just throw the whole line out there. You throw the whole line, you put one of your top two pairings out there and you blast away and you have guys just play hockey. Because once you start overthinking it now, this is a dangerous time for a power play. Like it doesn't usually come in these situations.
Are you an advocate at any point, Ziggy, of giving up possession of the puck on the zone entry with the man advantage? And what I mean by that is and the Leafs are not the only team in the NHL that does this, so I'll be very clear when I say it. The drop pass in the neutral zone and then the attempt to carry the puck in to the offensive zone. Well, the Winnipeg Jets lined up four guys at the blue line last night and just nipped that in the bud. Active sticks, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Would you ever advocate for chipping the puck behind the four guys lined up on the blue line, using your momentum up ice to try to get to that puck first and set up? I know pucks in deep is the phrase that we all love to make fun of. Kenny Reed does it every single night on Sportsnet Central. You do run a risk giving up possession. But is that an adjustment that you could make to get the defenders on their heels just a little bit or maybe force them to change course?
Yeah, I don't mind them through the neutral zone. I don't mind the zone entries. Teams have gotten a lot better at holding the blue line. That's not my area of concern for this team. I think it's been decent. I think they have to come up with something better when they kick the puck out, when they're just entering, just crossing the blue line. So, yeah, at this point, I don't, this is in zone, this is shot selection, this is getting pucks, effort level. I would just find something else right now because whatever they're doing in practice, which I don't know, it has to change. You have to do something. Either have no killers, have more killers, practice with, no one there, go on early. The best power plays usually never practiced it a lot. Like in Pittsburgh, when Crosby and Malkin and the power play was going, Gonchar, Letang, very rare. It was like a couple touches before practice for 10 minutes, and that was it. They weren't on the ice for hours after practice. It's a strange thing, the power play. I trying to explain it, and when it goes wrong, when it goes south and things go wrong and guys are finding a hard time to, you know, put the puck in, there's a lot more to it. It's not just go out there and shoot the puck. Go out there and do a low play. Matthews, just shoot the puck, or Marner off the flank. There's so much more that goes into it than that. So when you see the start they had and when you see a good power play, you know, we have to enjoy that time because it can go dry, and we're seeing that right now. You're going to have dry spells in your power play, but the 1-for-40 at this point, not scoring on a 5-on-3, that's an issue, and you're going to lose games if you can't put it in. I didn't even think they had a good chance. You know, Galchenyuk hit the post, but they need to generate something out of that 5-on-3.
We'll get Joshua Kloak on in the next segment from The Athletic. He covers the Leafs, and he covers Toronto FC. Their regular season, MLS regular season, gets underway this weekend with a match against, and don't do this, don't call them the Montreal Impact, because they are the Montreal Impact anymore. They are the Club de Football de Montreal. CF Montréal. Yeah. And then, of course, they're in the CONCACAF Champions League down to the round of eight, and Cruz Azul, Ziggy's favorite team, is next on the docket.
Yeah, near Acapulco. Yeah.
Is
one
it?
Of my favorites.
Is it near Acapulco? You had him near Cancun yesterday. I mean, yeah. What are you just going through all the resort towns?
Let's see. What do you know of Mexico? I know Cancun. I know Acapulco. I know Cabo. And I know Mexico City.
Yes. Ziggy, to be honest, Mexican geography is hard, you know, tucked away up there and everything. It's difficult. I get you. I'm right with you, buddy.
Yeah.
Here's a list. Kyle Lowry.
Okay.
Pascal Siakam.
Yes, sir.
OG Anunoby.
Mm-hmm.
They're resting. Here are the injuries. Bembry, a hamstring. Trent, an ankle. Jalen Harris, a hip. Freddie Van Vliet is expected to return and play tonight against the Orlando Magic. So here are the Raptors. And Zach LaVine of the Chicago Bulls, he's out in COVID protocol right now. So the Bulls are playing like crap, and they've lost their best player. The Raptors are one game back of Chicago for the 10th seed in the Eastern Conference. And in the tortoise race for the final playoff spot actually isn't a tortoise race for the final playoff spot. It's a tortoise race to see who can stay out of the final playoff spot. I know the Raps have been playing a ton of basketball lately, 7-10. They had a COVID situation a month ago that messed things up. I don't have a problem with what they're doing, but they aren't even bothering to try to hide the fact that they don't want to win basketball games. I'm not talking about the coaches and the players. The front office is content not to win basketball games right now.
Yeah, and it's tricky, right? Because I told you, when you're coaching a team, you don't want to tank. This is going against your record. I'm sorry, but if you're behind a bench, this stays on your record as a coach. And I know, well, you're a general manager, it's on your record as well. No, when you're a general manager, it's more about, you know, creating a winning culture. You want to be, you know, it's about titles. And I know the coaches, it's about titles as well. But you don't want down ears. Like, you think Nick Nurse wants to tank right now? No way. He wants wins. Coaches want, what's your winning percentage?
You're not you're not playing guitar with rock bands after a season in which you're 20 games under 500.
No. So that's the one thing. And there's another point, and I think we've mentioned it, but the whole DeMar DeRozan trade for Kawhi Leonard. And I don't want to go that far back.
Oh, but you're going there.
Well, I just going to say.
You brought it up.
You know what? Michael Grange has actually talked about it a couple times in his articles there on sportsnet.ca. He says the same thing. Like, would we be in this situation right now if DeMar DeRozan, Kawhi Leonard trade didn't happen? Like,
the answer to that question is no. And the answer is twofold. No, the Raptors would not have won an NBA title.
Okay.
And no, the roster would not look like it does right now.
This goes back.
Are you good with that or not?
Well, that's the thing. You got to ask Raps Nation, like, are you happy with the title? And now we're going to go through a little bit of a rebuild. like those moves for the DeMar and Kawhi? When Kawhi doesn't come back, you have to expect, and then Kyle's at the end of his contract and his, you know, career's kind of winding down. Like, this happens.
But it's like, also not scorched earth. Like, Freddie, Pascal, whatever they're going to be, they're going to be.
There's a framework.
But Freddie, Pascal, OG.
There's a core. There's a
core
to work from.
Found Boucher as a six this year, you know?
There is a core to work from, and I like what Freddie has done this year. I like the strides he's made. I think Pascal's taken a step back on many levels, on the court, off the court, just trying to be that number one. And this happens sometimes, right? You have a little regression with some of your stars and guys that are, you know, trying to make a name for themselves. And I think Pascal's in that weird spot right now.
Yeah, these next 13, 14, or 15 games, whatever they have left, they cannot go by fast enough for the Raptors and the coaching staff. And you mentioned, yeah, this has got to be tough for a guy like Nick Nurse. He's coaching. Everything in his body tells him to go out and win. But remember Brendan Malone, Raptors' first coach, he wanted to win. The message from management was like, no, we don't really want to win yet. And they rode him on a rail out of town here. So the likely starting five tonight, just handed to me by Hayden Mathewson.
You pronounced his name right, Hugh. This must be an off day for
you.
No,
I meant Holden.
You go. Yeah, okay.
Who the hell is Hayden?
Yeah.
Anyway.
What am I doing here, getting things right?
Fred VanVleet, Rodney Hood, Utah Watanabe, Chris Boucher, and Kem Birch.
Yeah, they're bad.
Hey, dude, 40% Canadian, baby.
Yeah,
no problem with that.
Neat. That's pretty neat. The Canadians are in the lineup, though.
That's fun and everything.
Canadians
in the lineup.
Well, but they threw spaghetti at the wall the other night against San Antonio, and it worked. They accidentally won a basketball game.
Yeah, no, what were they thinking?
But, I mean, I don't think you can go back and reset the clock. I'd take the championship and the framework of what they have right now. And if you're a Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster, I don't know if you ever cop to this. Why would you? But they're down in Tampa this year.
Yeah.
If you miss the playoffs, you get into the draft lottery. Who knows? Maybe you move up a couple of spots because they're not going to have one of the very worst records in the NBA. You move up a couple of spots, you get some fortune in the lottery. And maybe, just maybe, they're back in Toronto next year with maybe, just maybe, 18,000 fans in the seats. And then you try to get back into contention, whatever that means. I don't necessarily think they'd be top of the conference.
No.
But you're back into playoff contention and seeing what damage you can do. And you're back in Toronto in front of your home fans. If this is a season to sort of let it fall by the wayside, it's never the preferred route.
Yeah, there are worse seasons to tank in than this one while you don't have a home game. So the fans aren't on your back all the time. Yeah, if you're going to do it now. Get it over with.
We'll leave it there.
Yeah, it's a good place to leave it.
Yeah. Hugh gets the last word. I don't know if I'm ever comfortable with that. But
happens so rarely.
It's happened so rarely. Ben Wagner will join us in about 20 minutes. I think Anthony Kay deserves another start. And I'm going to mention that to Ben Wagner and see what he thinks. And there are multiple reasons for that. Go ahead, Ziggy. You've got your hand up.
Well, Tanner Roark was on the mound again.
Roark's been getting his tits lit.
Okay.
There we go.
All right,
And something I wanted to bring up with Ben as well is that I think it's unfair to Tanner Roark to have him go in when he did. He should have started the game.
All right. So,
and we'll leave it there. Thank you.
Scotty's falling out of his chair. Right,
ladies
now.
And gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, we have found the president of the Tanner Roark fan club. He stands alone. He pays you to join. How much membership costs.
He's defiant.
He pays you to join. And what's lost in a loss like last night, I mean, they were down 7-0. It ends up being 7-5. They had the tying run on base in the ninth inning. Vladdy is hitting the crap out of the baseball.
Awesome. Third home run last night.
114 miles an hour. Dan Shulman said this on the broadcast. Vladdy's got 10 at-bats this year where he's had contact of 110 miles per hour or better off the bat. The next most in all of baseball, 6.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on his double to left field. Later, he hits a career-long 456-foot home run to left center field in Kansas City. That thing was way back. I don't know if you've ever been to Kauffman Stadium. If you can get there ever, do. It's beautiful, number one.
It really is beautiful. Yeah.
And number two, it's a big ballpark. It's a pitcher's ballpark. You need outfielders who can go get the baseball. You hit a ball that far in that stadium, you've earned it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, there's no cheap ones there.
I mean, Vladdy is on some kind of fire. So we'll get into that with Ben Wagner. Josh Cloak of The Athletic on the Maple Leafs. We'll get into the power play, the goaltending situation, the schedule upcoming, because we're not quite sure what that is. And Toronto FC kicks off its regular season against Club Football de Montréal on the weekend. Don't call them the Impact. That's $5 in the tip jar every time I do. And Cruz Azul is the next opponent in the CONCACAF Champions League. Josh Cloak to talk about all of that next. Got a text from the 416 area code, Ziggy. Rourke fan club, LOL, he needs to be released.
Rourke's been getting his tits lit.
He's not used to going in out of the bullpen. He's a starter. Like, how do you expect a guy to start and then all of a sudden go in the bullpen?
Well, I do agree.
That's a lot to ask.
I actually do agree that it was tough asking him to come in with a runner on second base, but...
There you go.
I don't think that was the source of his struggles in that first inning of work. Could be the fact that the fastball doesn't sink, it doesn't cut, it doesn't have run on it, it doesn't fade, it just sits there. Right?
It was a tough start, and then he settled in. Yeah, but he settled in, and he looked good for a little bit. He settled in. Did he not settle in?
He settled in. I'll give them that. Yeah.
I mean,
they were down 7-0. They crawled back into the ballgame, made a thing of it, had the tying run up in the ninth inning, and that was their best hitter, right? Vladimir Guerrero Jr. So, yeah, I mean, he had a chance to tie the game. I guess that's better than nothing. It certainly didn't look early in the game like it was going to get to that point by the end.
Just some weird plays defensively, right? Like,
dude, it was like the left side of the diamond was a Bermuda Triangle. Last night,
Guriel, just what's he doing on those two plays? Like, what's he diving at that second one for? And then cutting off that turned into a triple.
Yeah, the first one
that went in the gap. Like, you got to cut that off. Do you not?
Yeah, the first one bothered me more because, look, he's shading to the left field line and he's playing relatively shallow. Now, that's where he's being positioned because the data that they have suggests that that's where Benintendi is going to hit the ball in the air if he goes that way. What you can't do when Benintendi goes for that high fastball on a two-strike count and deposits it into left center field is take a straight across route at the ball. You got to go like 45 degrees so that you can get in front of that thing or at least reach and cut it off so it doesn't roll all the way to the fence. I mean, that was an angle play. That Lourdes Gurriel Jr. just kind of messed up there. And that hurts. I mean, they gave away bases last night. Kevin Biggio was lost at third base, then comes out with hand pain. I don't know what that is, but.
Well, you're struggling when you start to stick up your other hand, like your non-catching hand to stop a ball. Like, it's like he put both hands in the air. I was just like, what's he doing? Like, what? I think he's just guessing right now.
Yeah, maybe he got nicked on the deflection there. And
He did. Yeah, he did. I mean, that's what it looked like to me. And that's just a player that doesn't have a lot of confidence right now. And you can see it in his play. He made a couple decent throws. Like, it's coming, but I don't know. Like, I don't think this infield is, like, I don't think we're going to see Bo and Cavan at short and third. Like, I don't think we're going to finish this way.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of experimentation going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it all feels so urgent right now because it's still early in the season and you're looking at a Yankees team that's off to a slow start. Baltimore's doing what Baltimore's supposed to do. Tampa Bay is off to a slow start. the question about Boston and its hot start is, will the pitching hold up? So if we assume the answer to that question to be no, the division is available early in the season. You can never win the division now. You can play your way out of it. They certainly haven't done that. So what you'll want is answers to these questions, and you want them to come sooner rather than later. I think that some of the answers to these questions are going to take a couple of months at the very least, and that's going to require some patience, and it's going to require us to sit through some baseball that looks as shoddy defensively as like what we saw from the left side of the diamond last night. We'll get back into this conversation with Ben Wagner in about 15 minutes time. The Leafs fall to the Jets 5-2 last night. Toronto FC advances and will take on Ziggy's favorite team, Cruz Azul. We're still, by the way, expecting the full scouting report on Cruz Azul at some point in the next round of the CONCACAF Champions League to discuss all of these topics. We welcome from The Athletic, covering the Maple Leafs and Toronto FC, Joshua Cloak, who is brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. What's up, Josh? It's been a while.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for that Lexus to show up in my parking lot. I didn't know that was sponsored by them. Yeah,
I'm checking the notes to see if
paperwork has been lost. I'm sure.
Here's the thing, man. You didn't sign by the X. That's
yeah.
That's
on me.
Yeah, you didn't sign by the X. The car ain't coming. Do you have an idea that hasn't been expressed yet about what to do with this one out of their last 43 Maple Leafs power play?
No, I don't. And I wish I did. And if I did, you know, I'd probably be driving that Lexus as a member of the Leafs coaching staff. But I think what Sheldon Keefe said last night that was particularly revealing, because he hasn't given us a lot, you know, in terms of, you know, worry, I guess, over the power play. You know, he was saying that when he watches guys on the bench, you know, when the team is on the power play, he sees them really kind of clenching up and tightening up and showing a bit of worry when guys are close to the net. So you can tell that, like, this is a problem that the whole team is concerned about. You can tell that, you know, this is a matter of guys just holding their sticks a bit too tight, and the lack of efficiency on the power play has kind of seeped into their own mindset. So, you know, and you know what that's like when you're worried about scoring and you're overly concerned about scoring, it becomes harder to do that. I mean, it's like that in any sport, right? When you're so worried and focused on doing that one thing, and, you know, you have this fear of making a mistake, that becomes a problem for you. So I think it's a bit of a mental thing for the team right now. You would think that once they get one or two, the floodgates will open. I mean, obviously last night without Nylander and Matthews, you're at a disadvantage right away. But yeah, I think it's a mental thing, and I don't have the answer for that. I wish I did.
Yeah, and with Matthews and Nylander not in the lineup, Foligno going to come in after he's done his quarantine. How do you think the front end's going to look once those three players get inserted into the lineup?
I mean, the easiest answer is possibly Joe Thornton comes off the power play and maybe, because I thought he looked decent last night, maybe Nick Robertson gets a few more reps in the power play. What else can you do right now besides changing up the personnel, right? Because you supposedly have a great power play specialist out there in Manny Malhotra, and you have, you know, a power play that was clicking before. So I guess that's one thing you could try, is really switching things up. I've long advocated for Nick Robertson to kind of be a member of this team, because you notice him when he's on the ice every single shift, sometimes for not the best reasons, but, you know, for a team that's really in that mid to late season grind right now, you know, a pair of fresh legs isn't necessarily the worst thing. So maybe he gets more reps. Maybe I don't know. I think it's just a bit late in the season to completely change, you know, the tactical approach. Maybe just, you know, you bring in guys that aren't as worried about scoring and just have a little bit more of that natural confidence that Nick would have built up in the AHL. Maybe that's the option. So yeah, I wonder if it's Thornton coming out. I would think Foligno would have to get a look too, because why not at this point, right? So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, with Robertson, I think he brings something that they don't have. He's kind of like a Mikheyev, brings that energy, the speed. I think he's a little bit better handling the puck through the neutral zone, and obviously his shot is for any of the young guys in the league. I think it's, you know, he's definitely up there for his release and the fact that he, everything's north with him, right? Everything's forward. But, you know, if once Matthews, Nylander, and Foligno do come in the lineup, it's looking like Robertson will be out, Brooks will be out, but that next name to come out is still up in the air. And I don't know if you had someone that you think should come out first, or you had a couple guys you think should rotate. What are your thoughts on, you know, three forwards that have to come out of the lineup?
Yeah, I think those names make sense. And again, like, as much as the last thing on Robertson, what I like is he just plays without fear, right? And he just plays with this kind of confidence that has been, is just really innate with him. And I think that's something that, you know, you don't always find in a young player. But in terms of the kind of the third forward that could come out, the name that sticks out for me is Pierre Engvall. He just, you know, he's shown it in fits and spurts this season, and he's such a talented skater, and he can move through the neutral zone really, really well. And, you know, we saw it against Calgary. He was one of the few players that could kind of break through that really tight kind of neutral zone kind of forecheck that the Flames had going on because of his natural stride. But he hasn't really been able to deliver what Sheldon Keefe wants in him, which is a little bit more physicality, you know, a lot more scoring, obviously. You watch him in the corners. He's a big guy and he moves really well, but he doesn't really apply the body in a way that, you know, you would kind of need out of that bottom six player. So he's one that, you know, I think has a lot of upside and a lot of natural talent, but really hasn't kind of taken that next step. So he's the one that if I were making the call, he's the one that would come out. But, you know, as we've established, I'm not driving the Lexus. I'm not making that call.
With Joshua Cloak of The Athletic covering the Leafs and Toronto FC, this is Leadoff Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So I think a lot of the goaltending talk, Josh, is predicated on the fear that the fan base has that the goaltending is going to be what sinks the ship at some point during the playoffs. Like, I think Freddie is fine. I think Jack Campbell is fine. But maybe there are going to be periods of time here, especially into the second season, when they need better than fine. And my argument is that somebody can say Frederik Andersen is a problem or the problem. That's okay. If you hold that opinion, that's fine. But that's different than also suggesting that somebody like Jack Campbell is definitively the solution with such a small sample size, number one, and number two, that small sample size that is so vastly spread out. I can hear point A, but I can't get myself to point B. I'm happy for Jack Campbell to take the reins and prove me wrong, but I can't get myself there yet.
Yeah, I guess the question for me is which one kind of inspires more confidence in a coaching staff? Is it Campbell or Andersen? I mean, I have a lot of concern about, you know, putting in a player who has never looked great in the big games. You know, we can talk about game sevens and game fives with Frederik Andersen, and that's what sticks out. And I think that as the Leafs coaching staff and, you know, Leafs management, I think that's what concerns them, you know, is how he plays when, you know, you have to put all the chips down, I guess you could say. And yeah, Jack Campbell doesn't have that big game experience yet. But when you look at the way that each of them play, which one looks more calm in goal? Which one looks more composed? Which one looks even a little bit more aggressive? And to me, that's Jack Campbell. I don't think there's any question anymore that he's the Leafs' number one goalie. And a lot of that is circumstance, right? Like, we don't know. The Leafs haven't given us any real timeline for Frederik Andersen's return. I mean, it sounds like sounds more and more like he's not going to be back in the regular season. You know, what Sheldon Keefe has told us is that this is the kind of injury that he'll tell the team when he's ready, right? So who knows when that will be. So I guess if you have to bet on one, you have to bet on the player that has shown you that kind of confidence and those strong performances recently. And again, it's just a matter of him looking more composed in goal. Frederik Andersen is, you know, at times this season, at times over the last two seasons, just looked a step slow, just not really looked into the game. And I know that's a hard thing to kind of judge and quantify, but we don't hear from him a lot, and that's kind of – this is what we're going off. I think that the team, you know, the players still have a lot of confidence in Freddie. He's a popular guy in the room. But just, you know, the eye test alone tells you that Jack Campbell just looks more composed and aggressive, and I think that's the guy you have to go with right now. Last night looks bad, and we know Jack Campbell has a history of being really hard on himself, but he also, you know, has a history of doing what he needs to do to improve. So I hear your arguments. I do, but I don't think there's any question right now who the Leafs guy is, who the Leafs horse is.
John Tavares has been picking up points as of late. Obviously, Nylander's not in the lineup. That's been his winger for most of the year. He gets his 14th, 38 points now in the year. Is that a line you'd like to, a pairing you'd like to keep together, or the fact that we've seen Tavares look so good without Nylander, do you split him up once Nylander comes back?
No, I really like Nylander and Tavares together, and I think that it seems like Foligno is the guy that's going to get, you know, placed on that left wing. That one just seems like it's the easy place to start. And what I like about Tavares, he's gotten so much better this season, you know, at playing good and using his strength down low, which is something that Nylander obviously doesn't do a lot. So if you pair those guys up and you maintain that partnership, you know, you kind of take advantage of Tavares' ability to use his strength in kind of the dirty areas and get Nylander to, you know, into the slot. So I think that's something you stick with. I think when Nylander comes back, you do want to ease his return and make things as easy for him as possible. He's been the first, you know, Leaf to have been out, you know, under COVID protocols. So, you know, there's probably a bit of pressure and anxiety with him coming back. So you want to make things as easy as possible for him. So stick with what you know. I mean, I think John Tavares playing the way he has, I don't think that's a byproduct of not having Nylander. I think that's him just, you know, weathering the storm really well and weathering those mid-season struggles. I mean, it's something we probably don't talk about a lot, but it's got to be difficult for a guy like Tavares, a young father, to kind of be away from home as much as he has this season and kind of under these weird circumstances. And, you know, he's the one that has to answer questions when the Leafs lose, and there's a lot of pressure on him. So kudos to him for kind of, like I said, weathering the storm and kind of figuring it out and kind of heating up when they need him to heat up the most, right?
Josh Cloak with us on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So Toronto FC kicks off its regular season against CF Montreal on the weekend. They have advanced in the CONCACAF Champions League to take on Cruz Azul, which one of the better clubs in Mexican soccer. Where's Toronto FC at right now, Josh, in terms of its trajectory? Like, you know, Tim Bezpachenko is long gone. Greg Vanney is gone. It's the Ali Curtis and Chris Armas show now. Seba Jovinko has been gone for a couple of years. So the transition has been happening. Where's Toronto FC at as we sit here today?
Yeah, and their win, you know, over Club Lyon in the Champions League was one that I don't think anyone saw coming. They now go up on Cruz Azul later in the month, and I still want to hear Ziggy's, you know, Cruz Azul origin story. I didn't know he was such a huge fan.
Die Hard.
Yeah. Maybe for another
day. It's near Acapulco, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He has no idea.
The story with TFC right now, I would say the most interesting storyline with them. I mean, we know that Chris Armas is a coach that prefers a drastically different style to Greg Vanney. Greg Vanney liked, you know, kind of a slow but methodical approach to offense, building from the back, holding onto the ball. Chris Armas just likes to play with this relentless pressing energy. And so when he was hired, there were a lot of questions for myself included about how's this going to work with a veteran team? How's this going to work with a team that needs to be healthy to play this style of football? And, you know, this is a team, TFC, that has long struggled with soft tissue injury. So it was a concern. So what Chris Armas has done, and to me is the most interesting thing about this team right now, is play young players that Greg Vanney never did. You know, TFC has sunk a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of resources into their academy over the years. And now we're seeing the fruits of that labor. We're seeing young players that aren't household names by any means. Noble Akello, you know, Jacob Schaffelberg, Jaden Nelson, Ralph Prezo. These are names, these are local products. These are players that were born and raised in the GTA, and they've spent years and years kind of coming up in this academy system. We know that the draft isn't, you know, a big part of MLS. And so Chris Armas is rolling the dice with these players, and it's working, right? He's showing that, like, if you have confidence in these young players and you give them the opportunity that maybe, you know, they didn't get under Greg Vanney, and that's no fault of Greg Vanney's, because his kind of MO was to win a championship every season. I had a conversation with Bill Manning, Toronto FC's president, yesterday, and he said that, you know, in the past, when they were looking to fill out their roster, they were looking for MLS proven veterans, you know, guys that had been around the block. Now those spots, maybe in the middle of the lineup, are going to their young players. So to me, that's kind of the most exciting thing, the most interesting thing about this team. And it's something that, you know, if you're a fan, maybe a casual fan, you can look at these players and say, oh, he's from Richmond Hill, he's from Brampton. And that's something that I think, if you're, again, if you're a casual fan, you can really get into.
Josh, before we let you go, Ziggy wants to offer some analysis on Cruz Azul. This is what he's got.
There is no Dana, only Zul.
No Dana, only Zul. That's all we got. We got the Ghostbusters. That's it. That's it. My God. All right. We'll let you go. We'll let you go and drive off in your Lexus.
He's just too big a fan to offer kind of unbiased analysis. I get it.
By the way, Cruz Azul plays in Mexico City, Ziggy, which okay. is not exactly next door to Acapulco, but
it's in the south. It's all in the south.
There you go. Josh, thanks for this. Lots of fun. Appreciate the insight.
Yeah, take care, boys.
Joshua Cloak, the athletic reporter for the Maple Leafs, and covering Toronto FC as well, brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit donvalleynorthlexus.com. Elliot Friedman at about 8:05 for his weekly Friday hit. Up next, Ben Wagner. I'll say Anthony Kay deserves another start, and we're crossing our fingers that the rain doesn't wash out the game in Kansas City tonight. I'll explain why, and we'll get Ben's reaction next. Now let's go down to a beautiful, lovely Dunedin, Florida, the home of our next guest, the play-by-play voice of the Toronto Blue Jays on Sportsnet Properties, Ben Wagner. How many cups of coffee have you downed? You're a coffee aficionado. How many are down the hatch already this morning?
I didn't want to peak too early, so I've only had one.
Only.
I didn't want to fire out of the gate and, like, rock you guys back on your heels, okay?
Hey, Ben, welcome to the show. What are you talking about? What, man, did you see that game last night? All right.
What's the coffee order?
I go to a little shop here in Dunedin that's recently opened up, and they do a great job of single-origin coffees, and this is a Peruvian.
Ooh. Ben, yeah, sorry, Ben, you lost me at I went outside to a store. I can't.
Yeah, what is that again?
I'm sorry. This is the Wild West.
No, we're the unwild East then, if you're the Wild West. I mean, we're not doing anything right now. Okay, so like the defense and stuff, we got to talk about that. But a couple of quick bullet points. First of all, let's hope the weather holds up in Kansas City, because if Steven Matz can make tonight's start with the off day Monday, he can pitch Wednesday in Boston, and then that would give the Blue Jays Ryu and Matz for the two games against the Red Sox. I think that's the most ideal starting pitching scenario. Bullet point number one, you can react to that if you want. Second one, though, I really want you to talk about this. I know the line wasn't pretty, but I think Anthony Kay did enough last night to earn another start. What do you think?
I'll start with two, because the defense behind Anthony Kay wasn't pretty either. Yeah, it was ill-advised, and there were things happening beyond the box score, too. The dive of Lourdes Gurriel Jr., his routes last night, I mean, early in that ball game, and it was just not a very good defensive game when Anthony Kay was in the game, and even after, to be honest with you. So I think Anthony Kay, one, should have got that start, will get another opportunity. I'm not sure, though, that a start necessarily will fall in his lap, only because of the off days that are built around the schedule of the next couple of weeks. There's just not a need to have a fifth starter. They can get by, the way that I'm looking at it, with Robbie Ray, Steven Matz, Hyunjin Ryu, and likely TJ Zoik.
So do you prefer Zoik to K?
Yes. Yes. Right now I do.
Okay.
I think there's a little bit more start, but you know, they're trying to cover innings with some injuries on the back end of that bullpen too, and I think that's gonna factor into who gets some bulk work in two or three inning jumps here. And that's where I think Anthony Kay will still have a role, and it might be a piggyback scenario with one of these guys, maybe even TJ Zoik, depending on what the ask will be. But I really think TJ Zoik has the trust and has done enough for the front office to keep giving him the baseball and be part of this four-man crew moving forward the next couple of weeks. And the stability of the Southpaws, on your first point, Scotty, with the stability of the Southpaws, I think has given the Blue Jays an opportunity to exhale with the way Steven Matz and Robbie Ray have thrown the baseball, not only in spring training, but even their first kind of go rounds. We've seen more of Matz. We're going to see more of Robbie Ray, which is a good thing because he threw the ball pretty well coming off the injury.
That was the Peruvian coffee jump in right there. So
yeah,
Benny
I thought you meant me for jumping in there. Ori, we got to talk about Tanner Rourke. I mean, I was joking around with Scotty earlier in the show saying, okay, he kind of struggled out of the gate because he's used to starting the games and now he's coming to the bullpen. Is there any actual truth to that, or we need to see a better performance out of Rourke?
You're going to need to see a lot of better performances out of Tanner Rourke. That's the bottom line. This is why he was shifted over to this role. And I'm a firm believer this is why they changed his approach as a starter, shifting him from a traditional windup over to the stretch, just to make this a little bit easier, not knowing the situation that he would have to jump into if he was pressed to enter a ball game out of the bullpen. This was all by design. I think this was something that the Blue Jays didn't trust going way back to the start of spring training. They had to have a contingency plan. They're paying him $12 million this year, and you just don't want to cut him loose if there is something there, even though it's going to be a mop-up role now. To me, I don't factor in, oh, this situation was really awkward for him, because this is a situation that kind of the comfortability on the mound has been pretty comfortable. And the bottom line is his stuff is short. You know, they just have not had life on the fastball. His secondary stuff has been too fat, and it's been a problem since he's been a Blue Jay.
Kevin Biggio leaves the game last night with right hand pain, presumably after he whiffed on that line drive that deflected off of his, I guess, partially his glove, but also partially his bare hand and into foul territory. You tell me, Ben, it was like there was a Bermuda Triangle-like vortex on the left side of the diamond that was affecting only Blue Jays defenders. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., I think you touched on the attempted dive on the fly ball down the line. I thought the pursuit of the Benintendi extra base hit was ugly. He came straight across. It was positioned well, right? I mean, he's playing in and he's playing over toward the line based on what the charts say about Benintendi. But then he runs straight across for the baseball instead of taking a 45-degree angle back and perhaps getting in front of it so it doesn't roll to the wall. He had a weird night in left field, and Cavan, up until the time he came out of the game, struggling at third. I guess this is just part of being a young team, and they're going to try and contend in the AL East while they figure some things out.
They've got to figure it out fast, and there's a lot of pressure building on it. I think we've seen the pressure on those two guys specifically, less because, for me, Cavan was pretty sharp, watching him daily and watching him so far in Dunedin. You know, I get a really close view being kind of field level for the majority of the game these days. I still think Kevin Biggio is going to be fine. I think Kevin Biggio's right hand is barking more than he's letting on. Remember a couple of weeks ago, and not a couple of weeks. Well, I guess it's been a couple of weeks now. Here we are on April 15th, 16th. A couple of weeks ago in a spring training game, there was a ball thrown from the outfield. Randall Grichuk threw to third base. Yeah. That ball with the runner diving in hit Biggio on the finger, the pinky finger, and it wrenched it off to the side, a way that the finger is not supposed to be bent. And he ended up missing a little bit of time in spring training. So he's been nursing a sore hand, and then the ball clipped the same hand. So I'm just factoring in both of those things, knowing that, you know, it's Barkin anyway. So that's probably the ultimate reason for the departure, and the fact that the cameras never found Kevin Biggio in the dugout yesterday told me there was something bigger going on here with the hand. And then after the ball game, Shai Davidi unearthed the fact that, you know, the x-rays came back negative. All good signs, but still, I think that the hand is sore for Kevin. And all spring long, and it's kind of been like an untold story for whatever reason, but like even last year, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. does not take crisp routes in left field. His bat is keeping him in the lineup. And you know, the other night against the Yankees, I thought Jonathan Davis, Josh Palacios, and Randall Grichuk were going to be the final three outfielders to finish off that ball game when the Blue Jays were trying to line up the win. But because things got tight, they kept Gurriel in there because he was scheduled to come up if the Blue Jays had to bat in the bottom of the ninth. So there's always a little bit of the roll of the dice for that shaky left field spot. There are defensive concerns still with this ball club, even though they tried to address many of them. There are some, at times, very glaring issues left.
Joel Pamps goes two scoreless innings. Do you think we're going to see him a little bit more now after his outing last night?
I think you're going to see him and Anthony Castro get open auditions as long as they can stay on the roster without getting crunched off. They're the first guys to go. They know it as well. They have DFA'd and they've re-FA'd Joel Pamps a couple of times over the course of the spring. So there is belief somewhere within the baseball operations department that this guy can help. This guy can have some success for the Toronto Blue Jays and the way they make out their bullpen. You just wouldn't reacquire the guys, given the scenarios, if they didn't believe in him. And then Anthony Castro came out and he threw the ball very well in his first go-around with the Blue Jays bullpen. And we got him in short sample sizes in spring training, but they know that there's a live arm there. He just has to throw strikes. But again, you know, you've got an opportunity here with injuries come opportunity. And here are two guys. First and foremost, I think you're going to see get kind of a run out of the bullpen, and hopefully it can hold together.
Whenever there's an ulnar description in a pitcher's injury, I get worried, right? The ulnar collateral ligament is the one that tears, and then the Tommy John ligament replacement surgery is had. There's an ulnar nerve in there. So I don't really know what ulnar neuritis is for Jordan Romano, but that's not great. Merriweather is down. Chatwood is down. The attrition here, stripling out of the starting rotation, the attrition here is quite serious, Ben. I mean, they've got a challenge on their hands right now.
A very big one. And look at the guys that haven't been available. Those names that you said with the emphasis of where they're supposed to throw in a ball game, go all the way back to losing Kirby Yates. The bicep is an issue for Tyler Chatwood. The oblique is just another concern for Julian Merriweather. And it's a lower oblique on the left side of his body, and that's the landing leg for a power pitcher. That's a problem. Yes, Jordan Romano with the ulnar, anytime that you worry, I freak out when I hear ulnar.
Well, I worry and when I hear forearm strain like we did for Stripling, right? Because that can always be a precursor to the elbow. Hopefully it isn't, but it can be.
Yeah, and that's not, you know, that's a guy that was just kind of forced into this rotation role. The Blue Jays ideally would have had him in the bullpen to begin with. There's a lot of concern. There is a lot of concern. We haven't seen David Phelps yet. He's still listed as day-to-day. So the Blue Jays have a fire drill right now trying to figure out who is going to, one, get big outs in a ball game, let alone who's going to round out this roster that you trust. There are a couple of guys left that I think are in the pecking order, like A.J. Cole, somebody that they rode a lot last year, didn't look so great in spring training. And then you've got Travis Bergen, which is another lefty that has been really throwing the ball well all through spring training and even towards the tail end of last year. And people continue to rave about his success. So there is a little bit more on the depth chart this year versus last year. But unfortunately, you're trying to tap into that depth chart. Now we're talking about the resources on Friday, April 16th.
Yeah, and it's Friday, April 16th, and we're still not talking about Nate Pearson as a guy who factors in at any point
way
soon.
Off.
I know he's throwing.
Way off.
But
yeah,
he's way off, and even when he comes back, I envision him as maybe an opener, give you two, three innings. You got to manage the innings as well as anything else with him. right?
Yeah, I mean, Nate's like a whole other chapter of this big book, because it seems like his entire career we have talked about managing Nate Pearson's innings, which is not, in my opinion, it's not fair to the kid. It wasn't fair to him in the minor leagues because he never really had to exert himself and work through a start, figure out what works well, how his body works when it's really exerted, tired, pitching on a travel day. He's never had sort of those boxes check in adversity to figure out how to do things if there is adversity when it really matters in the major leagues. And we didn't see the best Nate Pearson last year. We have yet to see an injury-free Nate Pearson so far this year, and he's way off, you know, from being even an opener, to be honest with you, 1 to 2 innings for this guy, because he just got on a mound for the first time, and, you know, what's that, 20 pitches. So I think they want him to be a starter when they come back. I just don't know that the clock is going to allow that the way things are going.
Well, thanks for sending us into the weekend on a good note, Ben.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
How about
it?
That? I gave you good coffee recommendations.
Yes. Peruvian brew. The next time
you've got that.
Somebody is allowed outside in this city.
Look, we didn't even pump the tires on Vladdy or Gritch.
Well, I know. I mean,
silver linings for next week, right?
Dude, Vladdy, I'm telling you, it's something. It is an event every time he comes up. And we will break it down even more. 110 miles per hour plus off the bat 10 times already this season. And then a career-long home run later in the game last night. Awesome, awesome stuff. We'll chat next week, and as always, we'll look forward to it.
Ziggy, Scotty, thanks so much.
You bet. Ben Wagner from Dunedin, a member of the Toronto Blue Jays broadcast team, play-by-play voice on the Sportsnet coverage. Here's what we're talking about this morning on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590. The Fan. Leafs fall 5-2 to the Jets at Scotiabank Arena last night. Jack Campbell was pulled after allowing 3 goals on 6 shots in the first period. The Leafs' power play on the night, 0-for-4, now 1-for-its-last-43. The Leafs head out on a road trip. And we'll talk to Elliot Friedman in just a moment about when the road trip could begin. It will not be tomorrow night. The Canucks will not play the Oilers tonight. And tomorrow night's game against the Leafs has been postponed at least by a day, as Vancouver now 3-plus weeks into a truly awful COVID outbreak. The Blue Jays, 7-5 losers in Kansas City last night. Vladdy had a big night, but it wasn't enough in a loss. Anthony Kay, Tanner Roark, both struggled to varying degrees. The Raptors back in action tonight. They got a game against the Orlando Magic, 1 game back of the Bulls for the 10th seed, the important 10th seed in the Eastern Conference. Lowry, Siakam, and Anobi will rest and not play. Bembry, Trent, Harris are hurt and will not play. Freddie VanVleet is expected to be in tonight's starting lineup. All of that ahead over the next hour of the program, including as well a visit with one of the newest members of the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. It was a long time ago, Ziggy. You and I don't remember this. I bet Elliot Friedman doesn't remember it either. Marv Levy was a head coach of the Montreal Alouettes through the mid-70s. Of course, he was also the head coach of those Buffalo Bills teams that went to 4 consecutive Super Bowls in the early 1990s. Marv Levy coming up at 8:35. But here he is from Hockey Night in Canada, Sportsnet's NHL Insider, 31 Thoughts, the blog and the podcast, Elliot Friedman. Morning, sir. Twice this week. You must be rubbing your hands with glee.
That's why I'm taking next week off.
What? I heard a rumor to that effect. That's
week off.
That's a fair trade. I'll give that to you. 2 this week,
wait
0 the
second,
next.
Wait a second.
He's got a quota to reach.
Off?
He's
Come
got a
on.
Quota. It's one a week. One a week. Putting your feet up.
Yeah, Ziggy, don't take it personally, man. I'm taking all my radio off next week. It's not just you guys. I debated telling Gentilly that it was just you, but I'm doing everything else. But no.
Is it the annual post-trade deadline detox? Is that how you would describe it?
Yes, that's pretty much it. All my radio next week. I've told everybody it's going to be a week off for me. So you're going to have to find other ways to entertain the people. Though we know it's not possible.
Is there anything else you do in this week of detox? Do you go on a juice diet? Is it strictly water and celery, or is it just like? Nothing. I'm just not doing radio, and that's it.
I think it's more like I actually talked to my family, I think is what happens.
That's good.
Basically it's like I'm still doing my regular TV duties. I'm just sort of, I'm just sort of, I don't believe in taking a week off TV, during the season. So I just say, okay, what's the best working vacation I can give myself? And that's it. By the way, Ziggy, how is he this morning?
He's pretty good. Okay. Not too bad, but I maybe he was saving it for when you come on, because that happens a lot, right?
Elliot, you got to understand my attention is split. I was lost in the vortex of the left side of the Blue Jays defense last night just as much as I'm lost in the vortex of the Leafs power play right now. So my attention is all divided.
I was wondering about that too. I know you're a big Jays fan, Scotty. So I was checking the score last night, and I said, like I don't know how this could go. This could mean he's doubly worse, or this could mean he's only half as bad.
Well, I guess we're about to find out. Let's start with the facts, Jack, if you got them.
Yeah.
If you were a betting man,
yeah,
where would you put your money for the next Leafs and Canucks game to fall?
So I heard you just say the game on Saturday has been postponed. I don't know if that's official yet, although we're all expecting it, unless it was announced this morning. I think it is going to be moved. To me, the biggest question is, are they going to play Sunday, Monday, or are they going to play Sunday, Tuesday? Like one of the reasons I think the full schedule wasn't announced yesterday is that they have a whole bunch of things they're looking at, and what's going to change and what isn't going to change. It's not just because that we're so late in the season. It's not just, oh, okay, we're moving this game here. There's other ramifications. And one of the things I would think the Maple Leafs have brought to the league's attention is that they play three games and four nights with Winnipeg next week.
Yep.
Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday. And those are probably the three games now, the three biggest games of the Maple Leafs season. And, I don't think Toronto's crazy about playing five games in 7 days, especially not those three. So what I'm guessing here is that the league, with the input of the Maple Leafs, is trying to figure out, okay, what's the best thing that we can do here? So that's why I don't think we have an official announcement about, okay, Saturday's off. When's it going? I think they're going to play Sunday. I do, barring any changes today. Nothing obviously is set in stone anymore in life, but I think they're going to play Sunday. My question is, how's the rest of that week going to go?
Okay, so, but if they play Sunday, would the consideration for not playing Monday be Vancouver back-to-back, coming right back? Because the Monday game is scheduled as is.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, like, Elliot, it isn't just the three games and four nights in Winnipeg and the five and seven. You cannot ask the Maple Leafs to play Tuesday night in the Pacific time zone, then fly overnight to the Central time zone, lose 2 hours in the process, and play a game as important as the one they've got in Winnipeg. That just can't happen.
I would tend to agree with that, Scotty. I have to check and see this year if anyone's done that. All I heard last night was things are kind of in a flux and we don't know the answers yet. But I do believe the Maple Leafs have looked at that, I don't know if it would let the league know is the right thing, but I know that they wanted to protect that schedule against Winnipeg in terms of, these are huge games for us. We'd like to be at our best for them. We're now going to look at five games and seven nights. Is there anything that can be done here? So I think that's one of the things they're kind of looking at.
If you had to guess now, does Vancouver play all their games to finish the season?
That's a great question. I still think they're going to try to do that. As it stands right now, they're going to be a couple days behind of, where the league hoped to have them be. you know, the other thing too that gets affected in this is there's a game against Edmonton, and Edmonton's schedule, which was supposed to be tonight, and Edmonton's schedule was already redone once, right? After the Montreal outbreak. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's tricky. I'm not going to lie to you, Ziggy. Again, I always go from the point of view that I think that's what the league wants to do. And that's, I think, what they're going to try to do. But I don't know yet. Like, one of the reasons, like, you know, this the whole thing this week, you know, I had a long talk with someone yesterday. You know, even before Miller spoke up, there was no guarantee they were going to play tonight. You know, I've gotten a bit more clarity, and, you know, even though the game was scheduled, it was always going to depend on how the Canucks did on their post-COVID testing yesterday. And, you know, I don't, like, they've shut down media access. They're not letting the media watch practice. So I don't know how many Canucks skated yesterday, but what I heard was the biggest concern was, even if guys came off the list, how many players they would have to play in these games after the testing. And, you know, I heard that if the game got canceled or postponed last night, it was going to be because they just didn't have enough guys who were ready to play in terms of, okay, this is how they test and this is how they feel. And, okay, we can't do this. And, you know, I heard when they came out of testing yesterday, they knew they just weren't going to have enough guys. And I think they were worried about the same thing for tomorrow. And that's why the games got moved. And I believe that was always kind of what they were thinking. And so I just think it comes down to, Mike, when they think they're going to have enough bodies. And right now it looks like Sunday's that day.
Elliot Friedman is our guest from Hockey Night in Canada, the NHL on Sportsnet. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The Leafs goaltending situation, and I think the question pertains to what you know about Freddie's health.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting here now, Elliot, thinking if somebody wants to say that Freddie is a problem or a challenge for this team, or the mm-hmm. problem or the challenge this team faces, I can listen to that comment. What I'm not as sure about is anybody who can definitively tell me that Jack Campbell, in a small sample size, that's spaced out, is most certainly the solution. Doesn't mean he can't be, but how can you possibly know that right now? I think there's a lot of fear in this Maple Leafs fan base that this really good hockey team could be sunk at a crucial time by its goaltending. All of that said, what do we know right now about Freddie, and is this a bit of a Dominic Hasek Ottawa situation after the 06 Olympics, where they're just waiting for him to tell them when he's good to go? And of course, that dragged on through the playoffs with Hasek, and the Senators were eliminated before he ever came back.
Yeah, this is the panic I was waiting for. Okay, so you know, last night I was watching the game and I got a text from a buddy when it was a big Leaf fan when Campbell left the game. And it simply said, uh-oh, the clock has struck midnight. Cinderella, it's over.
Pumpkin,
and
I'm like, pumpkin. Oh, here we go.
And like, oh my God, here we go. Like, I've been waiting for this. You know, look, like on Anderson, what I understand is that he felt that he played hurt and it affected his performance. He did it because Campbell was hurt too and the team needed him. And what I've been told is that he's not going to play until he's 100% ready. And they believe that that's going to happen. He'll be back this year. Although now, because they went into LTI to make their moves, you know, it's going to be tougher to do that. So I'm curious to see about how all this is going to work out. But again, I've been told he's not going to play until he's 100%, but they do expect that to happen. I mean, I'm not going to, like, I'm just not by nature a panicker. I think Campbell's been pretty good. I think he's proven he's a really improved goalie. And, you know, I thought they got the best insurance that they could get. You know, I'm not going to overreact to that last night. I still think, look, they don't have, you know, 2015 Carey Price. Like, I get that. But I think between one of these guys, they're going to find someone who's consistent enough to play, and I'm not going to overreact to what happened with Campbell last night.
Who do you think is going to play the most amount of playoff games between the three of them?
I think that's just impossible to answer right now, Mike, because we don't know what Anderson's health is like. Like, to me, it comes down to, can he play games before the season's over? Mm-hmm. You know, if the answer is yes, I think he's got a chance to be your starter. Like, right now, to me, Campbell's the guy. Like, he's had an unbelievable run. They obviously really like him and trust him. You know, like, to me, he's the guy. It just makes sense. With Anderson, it simply comes down to, are they going to be able to give him games before the end of the regular season? You know, if he hasn't played in 2 months, are you throwing in there for game one of the playoffs if the LTIs are off and now you can put him in? I can't see it. So that's the biggest question for me is, when does Anderson allow himself to play games, or his health allow him to play games? That's what I'm wondering here. And the Leafs have been really tight about it. To be honest, I don't know if the concern is the right word, guys, but, you know, I'm wondering about Matthews here. Yeah. If you look at the play that, you know, we think he got hurt on, it was a pretty innocent looking play. And, you know, if the wrist thing is just this annoying, nagging thing that he's going to deal with the rest of the year, that would be something that I would be a little bit more, I would be more wondering about than the goaltenders right now.
Right, because with Austin not in the lineup and Willie still out in COVID protocol, it they've got numbers. Obviously, every team has quantity, but the depth takes a significant hit, right? Well, I mean, we often refer to depth in the bottom six. When you lose two of your top four forwards, it looks a lot thinner, a lot quicker.
Yeah, and, you know, the good news is Tavares has really started to go, and that's important for them. But, you know, Matthews, I mean, at the end of the day, he's one of the best players in the league, right? He's a Hart Trophy guy. He's in that list. So, you know, if, you know, I would, like, right now I'm looking at it today and I'm sitting and I'm thinking, like, is this something we're going to have to deal with for the rest of the year? And if so, I would just be concerned about that because I think the guy's had a monster year and he's obviously so critical to the fortunes of the franchise.
We'll leave it there, Elliot. You enjoy your week off. It is well earned. And
I am old enough to remember Marv Levy as a coach in the Canadian Football League.
There you go. You would have been a young, young kid. No question. So when we talk to you next, it'll be April the 30th, the end of the month. Who knows? Who knows what we could be worried about by then, Elliot? Who knows?
I hope that left side of the defense improves for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. 13 into 162, and I'm already losing my head on that. We'll talk in a couple weeks. Have a good next week.
Take care.
Elliot Friedman, who will watch tomorrow night on Hockey Night in Canada, also from the NHL on Sportsnet, essentially the same thing. And 31 Thoughts, both the blog and the podcast. Something to chew on for great Canadian meat, the great Marv Levy. I would argue headlines the class of the 2021 Canadian Football Hall of Fame inductees, born on the 3rd of August, 1925. He's 95 going on 96, born in Chicago. He has coached everywhere from Coe College to New Mexico to Cal Berkeley to William & Mary, and then in the NFL, the kicking coach for the Philadelphia Eagles, special teams coordinator for the LA Rams and Washington, head coach in Kansas City and, of course, in Buffalo, and had that period of time with the Montreal Alouettes. An amazing life, an amazing football life. And we will celebrate Marv Levy's induction into the Canadian Football League with Marv himself next.
Canadian Football Hall of Fame is out with its induction class for the year 2021, and we are pleased to be joined by the person I would argue is the headliner of the list. He is the former head coach of the Buffalo Bills, the team that went to four consecutive Super Bowls in the early 1990s, and prior to that, and hence his induction into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame, the former head coach of the Montreal Alouettes for five seasons in the mid-70s, during which he won two Grey Cups. We welcome to the program the great Marv Levy. Mark, thanks for your time this morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine, and I appreciate your kind comments. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to the great fans there, and hope they're all doing well during this terrible coronavirus pandemic campaign, and that we conquer it, too.
Absolutely. So let's kick off with your time in Montreal from 1973 to 1977. 5 years, you win two Grey Cups, 74 and 77. You've come from the NFL, where you were a special teams coordinator. What was the adjustment to Canadian football like for you, and what led you to come north of the border?
Okay, well, very interesting. Yes, I spent 5 years there out of a 47-year-long coaching career, but they sure were memorable years in many ways. I hadn't known much about it before I arrived up there. But through a bunch of my previous coaching career in the States, in college, and with some of the pro teams, there was a scout for the Montreal Alouettes, who later became their general manager, I should say, named J.I. Albrecht. And he used to come to the practices where I was coaching, and we struck up a friendship. And apparently he was favorably impressed with my coaching. And we had just gone to the Super Bowl in the 1972 season when I was with the Washington Redskins. And he recommended the Montreal Alouettes team owner, Sam Berger, that he interview me for the position. I was glad to go up and be interviewed. I was enamored with the city, with the history of it, with Mr. Berger, his young family, and all the people I met. And when they offered me the job, I took it. There was a lot to learn. I realize that. The rules are different, the size of the field different, how many men in motion and what all that. But you're making adjustments all the time as a coach, and I'm sure in every other profession as well.
How did that experience help you get back to head coaching in the NFL? Because you were, like you said, you're an assistant coach with Washington the year before you go to the Super Bowl. Then you go coach in Montreal and then come back to the NFL. How did that whole experience in Canada, help you become a great NFL coach?
Well, again, I had been an assistant in the NFL for a while. My last 3 years under a great coach who's a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, George Allen. And I learned a lot, but going up to Canada to become a head coach, you experience some wonderful things. You realize that the popularity of the game is dependent on three almost equally important components. One, the participants, players and coaches. Two, the fans who get, and three, the media that conveys between them all. And so, but I learned a lot. I learned how much you have to adapt to the situation. So many different rules. Jokingly speaking, when J.A. Albrecht offered me the job, he said, Marv, you can have 12 men on the field. In Canada, there were only 11, of course, as everybody knows, in U.S. football. I said, oh, great, okay. And after my first game, I walked into J.A.'s office and said, Jay, you didn't tell me the other team could have 12 men, too. Well, so what?
Yeah. And how many times, you got to make quick adjustments, Marv. There's no question about it. But how many times were you able to go outside the box because you had that extra guy? What kind of adjustments did you make? How creative were you able to be, perhaps in ways that you hadn't been before?
Well, first of all, there is a lot to learn when you go up there, but something I found out very soon, and that pervaded all the time I was there, or whether it was in the Canadian League or coaching in the U.S., was this. It takes, even though there are differences in the rules and you have to adapt to it, you're always making adjustments. The game always changes. The nature of the game always changes. But I did realize that whether you're playing in the U.S. or in Canada, if you run, throw, block, tackle, catch, kick better than your opponent, you're going to win most of the time. Fundamentals. You have to, teaching fundamentals is the most important thing. Not the strategies and what formation you're running and if you're in a no huddle or what. Those things, you make them work. But if you can't handle the fundamentals better than your opponent, you're not going to win.
Marv Levy is our guest, and he is now a member of the Canadian Football Hall of Fame class of 2021, one-time head coach of the Montreal Alouettes, and of course the head coach of the Buffalo Bills from the mid-80s until the late 90s. You're listening to Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
What were some of your most memorable moments coaching in Buffalo?
Well, how much warm clothes I had to put on towards the end of the season. Well, I came to Buffalo, and the weather was rough there. So when the team owner, Ralph Wilson, a wonderful guy, offered me the job, he said, Marv, there are two seasons here in Buffalo. He said, the 4th of July and winter. And I learned what great fans there were. They were so supportive, even when we lost those Super Bowl games, how supportive they were. I once had told them in a huge meeting downtown that you are the reason we'll go back to the Super Bowl. Great fans there, and possibly you know this, but about 20% of the fan base that came to our games when I was with the Buffalo Bills did come from Canada, across the borders.
And that is still true to this day, Marv. I mean, there's a huge Bills fan contingent around the Golden Horseshoe. And, of course, for a few years, the Bills would play one home game each year in the Rogers Centre here in Toronto.
Right.
When you look back on your days as the head coach of the Bills, I want to get to the Super Bowls in just a moment, but one of the regular season rivalries that obviously stands out of the AFC East is Buffalo-Miami. I know people who are newer to the game or younger are going to say, well, where do the New England Patriots fit into this? They came a little after your run. But Buffalo-Miami, Jim Kelly, Dan Marino, Marv Levy, Don Shula. I mean, you must look back on that time and just think, wow. I mean, when you're living it, you're feeling the pressure, but you look back, I mean, those were some epic, epic games twice a year.
Yes, they were. And I was competing against another head coach for whom I had such high regard. Don Shula and I, he passed away just about a year or so ago, remained good friends. I had great regard for him. We exchanged many communications. But he was the essence, the winningest coach of all time in the NFL, of course. And he taught clean football. He honored the game. And our fans in both places were not abusive. The fans, yes, they competed strongly with each other, and I'm sure they had great fans. We did, too. I can't tell you how many times I've been in airports all around the country, and someone will come up to me and say, I'm the number one Buffalo Bills fan. And finally, I had to say one day, I've never met the number two Buffalo Bills fan. But that happened.
Four times you go to the Super Bowl between 1990 and 93. What were those years like? Because just getting to the big dance is so tough. And as a fan, as a Bills fan, just my team getting there is I'd be happy with, right? How many teams don't even, have a shot at it? Was that tough after the first couple where you're like, okay, we get there the first year, doesn't happen, second year. Was there added pressure those third and fourth years?
Well, the reason, one of the main reasons we did wasn't just the ability on our team, it was the character of the members on our team. And I can remember the day I was interviewed for the head coaching job, general manager Bill Polian, my wonderful friend now too, sitting in the office with team owner Ralph Wilson, for whom I have great regard. We all, I don't know who suggested it or brought the subject up, but we all decided we would bring a board on our team only people of high character. Now, their personalities might differ. Some might be extroverts, some introverts. But did they show up for work on time? Did they not blame their teammates? Did they work hard on fundamentals? Were they good citizens? Those were the only kind of guys we brought onto our team. Once in a rare while, we might have made a mistake, but we didn't keep a guy like that very long. So that's this is one of the reasons we bounced back. That plus, as I say, the tremendous support we got from the Buffalo Bills. So many of them just kept, you know, cheering us back on despite the bitterness of losing those games. I do recall one. There's an exception to every rule. On a radio show I used to do a day or two after the game, and when we lost, I think our second Super Bowl, one fan calling in and saying, "Coach, please don't go back to the Super Bowl. I can't stand it. It hurts. It's killing me." I said, "Sir, I understand your anguish, but I'm glad you're not on my team."
That's great line. Great line. You know, Ziggy and I had the opportunity. This was obviously before the pandemic. It was the kickstart to the 2019 NFL season, if I remember correctly. Daryl Talley came into studio with Ziggy and me. And I'll tell you, Marv, if Daryl Talley had told me to go out and fly a plane, I got no business being a pilot, but he could have motivated me to do it. I mean, you talk about high-character guys. Just the 20-minute conversation we had with him that day, man, oh, man, that guy was a warrior in the middle of your defense.
That's true, and I used to say about Daryl, he not only had character, he was a character. I tell you, I don't know if you got a word in edgewise when he was there. But he was a great leader on our team, Daryl, and it was a different personality, very entertaining in many ways, and I still stay in touch with him from time to time.
Who's somebody that impacted you as a coach? Either a coaching clinic, seminar, or somebody you worked under?
Well, George Allen, certainly. I was an assistant to George in the NFL, and he was a magnificent leader. He did focus on fundamentals. George never used a swear word in his life. It was always dad dratted or something like that if he got upset. But he was a great teacher. And then when I was just a young college coach, even an assistant beginning in college, I went one summer to a clinic all over the country where the most outstanding college football coach in the country, Bud Wilkinson, was speaking. And about the sixth one I went to, he looked down to you and said, "Are you here again?" And he said, "Come here." He invited me up to his room. He invited me to their practices. I got to know him. He was another guy who, what a football coach, what a man of high character, had great impact on my coaching career.
Marv Levy is our guest. He is going into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame class of 2021. This is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Just a couple of more items regarding the four Super Bowls, Marv. Scott Norwood always got a bum rap. I mean, I can understand criticism of a guy who misses a chip shot, 27, 28, 30-yard field goal the last second. I get it. I mean, that would be tough in and of itself, but I'd understand it more. Scott Norwood missed a 47-yard field goal wide right. All the flack he took, how hard was that for you, the team, to experience, and how did you rally to his side?
Well, yeah, okay, that's a great story. What people don't know is Scott was with us for two of our Super Bowls, the first two. And Yes, he missed that kick, and we lost the game, and I'll come back to it in a minute. But there were, during that season, six games that we won in the dying seconds when Scott kicked the winning field goal. Okay, back to the loss, the wide right, 47-yard field goal with just 8 seconds left to play. We arrived back in Buffalo. And when we arrived there, we were supposed to go back to our facility and we had a final team meeting. But instead, the buses took us to downtown Buffalo into, golly, I can't remember the name of the square. We were ushered into a city hall building, out onto the balcony, and down below were 30,000 people welcoming us home after the loss and cheering the team. And wait till next year, they were chanting. And then they started to chant, "We want Scott. We want Scott. We want Scott." Scott stepped up. He's a rather quiet, soft-spoken guy. But he did say, look down, and he said, "You are the reason we will be going back to the Super Bowl next year." And in the following, and in both those Super Bowls we went to, as I may have said already, Scott kicked the winning points on the way to him in several games.
That's I remember the city rallying around him. I also remember all those people saying, you know, how do you miss a field goal like that? It just always stunned me. The cool thing for us Canadians, Marv, is that after Scott left the Bills, Steve Christie, who's from the GTA, Oakville, came in and kicked for you guys and did a great job. What made Jim Kelly great?
What made Jim Kelly? Well, certainly his character, his raw ability, and his teammates, and a family. He was one of six brothers, several of them very good football players. He had great parents. I met them. But Jim Kelly, he had raw ability, but he was tougher than 47 miles of detour. He could bounce back. He had the greatest backup quarterback that ever played the game that helped push him forth in Frank Reich, now an outstanding coach at the Indianapolis Colts. But there were so many things. Jim Kelly had character. He's now a wonderful father and husband, still living in Buffalo. Funny thing, Jim had not wanted to be drafted. He went to school down at the University of Miami, even though he's from Pittsburgh. He had not wanted to go to pro football in Buffalo. He didn't like the weather, he said. And after about 10 years there, Jim Kelly said, "No one ever wants to come to Buffalo," he said. "And once they get here, no one ever wants to leave." He hasn't left. He's still there.
All right, I got to ask you something personal. Turning 96, you sound great. I've seen you do media interviews on some U.S. networks. What's your secret?
Well, really, I never did drugs. I smoked so briefly, you know, just a few cigars, and I gave that up. Any drinking I do is very moderate. As Dean Martin once said, he drinks moderately. He just ordered a case of moderately today, but I won't say that one. surrounded by great family, starting with my parents, my wife, my children, my whole family. I have a huge family. My father was one of 13 children. So I got a cousin. I can't go anywhere downtown here in Chicago for a walk without someone stopping me and saying, "I married your cousin Jerry's granddaughter Sylvia." You know, okay, fine.
Last one for you, Marvin. I'm going to cop that this is almost grotesquely personal because we're in Toronto, not in Chicago. But I know you're a Chicago native. I happen to have been and still am a Chicago Cubs fan for my entire life. You were at, prior to 2016, the last World Series game at Wrigley Field in 1945. What do you remember of that particular day, and how much did it mean to you that the Chicago Cubs, after 108 years, exorcised that demon in 2016?
Well, I'll tell you, yes, I grew up a Cubs fan. I loved the Cubs growing up. But now, and the Cubs have been to World Series in 08 and then in 29 and 32 and 35 and 38. They'd lost them all. But World War II has just ended. I was in the Army Air Corps, home on furlough, still hadn't been discharged, home on furlough, and I'm sitting with my friend, Herb Melnick's his name, in his home in Chicago, listening to game number 6. Cubs were down 3-2. The Cubs won the game. Now it's going to be game number 7 the next day. No night baseball then. Herb and I rushed down the Wrigley Field hoping to buy tickets for the game. We got in line. The line was 8 blocks long, I think. And some Cubs personnel, front office personnel, came walking down the line. Everybody in uniform, and Herb and I were still in uniform. We're just home on furlough. They moved up to the front of the line. We bought the tickets. They cost 55 cents then to see the 7th game of the World Series. And when the Cubs lost the game, we're walking out after the game, and Herb, who was a character, started yelling, "Wait till next year! Wait till next year!" Well, that's what we did from 1945 until 2016. And finally, the Cubs got back there, and they invited me to come to one of the World Series home games and lead the singing of the national anthem. And I was asked to write a book, which I did, for children called Coke. Go Cubs Go, which was a fictional type of history of the Chicago Cubs. Boy, you got a long-winded answer for that one.
Hey, I loved every word of it. Listen, sir, it's an absolute honor to speak to you, and Ziggy and I both congratulate you on this honor, a long time coming, 2021 Canadian Football Hall of Fame inductee. A wonderful first 95 years. Here's to 95 more.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you and communicating with your listeners and the fine fans up there. Thank you.
The great Marv Levy. We're back 6 o'clock Monday morning. Good show next. Have a great weekend.
We want Scott. We want Scott. We want Scott.